Thanks for downloading the show. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. My name is Eric. I'm your host. It's an eclectic DIY show. We talk about anything that you, maybe you could do it yourself. Today we're doing talking about the soil tests I had done at the university for my raised bed gardens, and I roped in Scott, our resident agronomist, and Rick, my co-host, who know more about this than I do. So welcome, guys.
Good morning, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, Scott.
Yeah, I'm doing well, too.
Good.
Thanks for
good.
Having me.
So I made a video about this on my YouTube channel, but I showed how to, at least how UConn, University of Connecticut College of Agriculture, Health and Natural Resources, wants you to do a soil test. You go throughout a raised bed. You want six to eight samples, mix it in a bucket, and then take a cup of that, put it into a zipper bag, and send it to them. I have six raised beds, and each two are like a pair. I built one set, then I built another set and another set. So the soil in the pairs, if that makes sense, is about the same. So I just did three samples because they're $15 a pop. And, you know, we're cheap. So, and I sent three samples. I got them back by email, and they are a nightmare. And so I immediately sent them to Scott. And he's like, let's talk about this on the podcast. So here we are.
Yeah, here we are. So
am I normal, Scott? Is my soil normal?
No, I'd say actually to me the soil looks like it's in really good shape. The only thing that's really a little bit low is the potassium. But everything else there... everything else there looks really good. So do you want me to kind of go through a little bit of what we're seeing here?
Right. So let me just describe the sheet. I'll list this in the show notes and I'll put this on the website, but you know, there's some text at the top and then there's a graph showing the bar graph showing calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium. And the phosphorus is in the excessive column, but yeah, walk us through it, Scott.
Yeah. And I mean, so let's go like calcium, magnesium, phosphorus. So they have those, and the potassium, they have those as the main ones here. The main one that I'm looking at is the phosphorus and the potassium, because the calcium and the magnesium are so high. Like those numbers there, like they give 3,200 pounds per acre and magnesium 500 pounds per acre. That's high, but that's expected for soils. And so those are nutrients that the plants are going to need, but there's lots of them there. The phosphorus is always, I think in almost every soil is always going to be one of the lower ones. It's one of the toughest nutrients for the plants to get a hold of. And so if it's in what they call excessive, I wouldn't call excessive, but I did read their stuff that showed that, they have laws about the phosphorus because of, that it gets into the waterways.
Right, it can leach out of your soil into a stream, and then it creates an algae bloom in a lake or an ocean or something.
Yeah, and so that's why, like, what they call excessive, I wouldn't necessarily call excessive, but it's at the optimum level. So,
wow.
So your phosphorus is good. Like, and actually, relatively, but all of the beds are fairly similar.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, and that's where, like, when you're looking at soil tests, because you're only looking at, you know, what you grabbed out of there. So if you have a number, so say like the potassium I'm looking at, and it's saying 94 for the one of them, 77.
94 pounds per acre.
Yeah, 105 and then 141. So, you know, obviously the one that has 141 probably has more, but they're all kind of in that same range of what they call below optimum, which I would say, you know, which makes sense to me. And I mean, like, they are giving these in pounds per acre, which I mean, in a garden it's very hard to imagine what that means, but but it makes more sense to me because these are the numbers that I'm used to seeing. So it's just a matter of, and they have the calculations there as to what you could actually put on. So
Yeah, because then they give you some solutions. But since I have the built-in expert, I just sent them to you and said, what do I do?
So really, like, the bottom line on this is that, like, if you can find a potassium source, which on the fertilizer bag would be the third number, like you have the NPK.
Yes.
Or that, yeah, so it's the third number. So if you can find something that has that, whether it's an organic product or a synthetic product, whichever one is kind of your most accessible or cheapest one, that's what you'd be looking for. So
why doesn't the soil test report nitrogen, or does it?
I was wondering about that, because I was surprised.
Maybe I didn't pay for that.
You know, I was surprised to not see it there, but I do know that there are labs where they don't do the nitrogen because it changes so much, and in soils where you generally have enough rain, or you have more rainfall that will kind of that can leach out the nitrogen, I think that's what they don't test for that, because it can change so much. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of surprised to not see it there.
And then they just, on below the bar graph, is different elements are listed: boron, copper, iron, magnesium, manganese, zinc, sulfur, and aluminum. Is that anything I have to pay attention to?
The only one I noticed was that they, the copper seemed to be low according to their soil test range.
Uh-huh.
But I will say that generally these micronutrients, which is what they have listed here, though sulfur is kind of one of the, kind of fits halfway between the macro, which are the ones that are the heavy feeders in these micronutrients. But even the sulfur is good. But for any of the micronutrients like that, like the boron, copper, iron, manganese, zinc, the only time you'd really ever need to add those is if you thought you had a problem. So if you're having poor growth, and you can look up pictures of your particular, whatever crop it is that is showing the deficiency, or shows like that it's not growing well, then you might add something from there, or you can get a test. You could get a tissue test, but I think it's probably going to be more expensive than it's worth it for a garden. So,
right, for my sugar snap peas, very expensive sugar snap peas.
it would be, and that's where, so something like something like any of these micronutrients, you know, maybe you, if you think you have a problem, you get one of those foliar spray, like with all the micronutrients in, is probably going to be the cheaper one, and just see a difference. But the caution is, with a lot of these micronutrients, they can go, you can go from deficient to toxic very fast, so that's why you have to be careful with them.
Is the seaweed spray, or like the, don't they have like a manure seaweed spray, fish emulsion seaweed spray, one of those things that has micronutrients?
That would probably, I'd have to see what the label says on it, but that would probably have what you're looking for. And you know, the other thing too, you add compost to these.
Yes.
So most of the time, compost will have all those micronutrients in sufficient or high quantities. So you're very rarely going to see a problem with those. So,
all right. Rick, what are you, any thoughts, Rick? Any questions?
Well, you know, I am not crippled by abundance of knowledge. And so I was looking at this and just kind of wanted to go back to the basics of what I saw. I just dropped a chart in the chat to you guys about the uptake of all these different micronutrients and whatnot in relation to pH, which I think is really one of the more important things most gardeners overlook. I see your soil pH is 6.5, Eric.
Uh-huh.
And that's good. That's maybe just a tad low. 7, they like to say, is the normal pH, but you know, it's right in that range. But what happens if you start getting too low down into the 5 or 5.5 or too high into the 8.5 range of pH? Is that even though all the micronutrients and the major nutrients are there, they become less accessible to the plant. The plant, they're there, but the plant can't convert them if the pH is too high or too low. And so managing your pH is really probably the single, I think, the single most important thing about, you know, fertilizer and gardening. Am I wrong in that, Scott?
Yeah, that the pH is really important. And actually, yeah, that's something I was noticing on all the tests. It's right around that 6.5.
Which, right.
Is pretty well perfect for, like, even on that chart there, like almost everything is fairly available at that pH.
Right.
And I have perfect soil.
Yeah. Practically perfect in every way.
Practically perfect. Yeah. And really, yeah, the pH is something that you monitor that, when soils are geologically young, it'll be usually higher, and then as they age over millennium, then it usually goes down because some of those are leached out over time. So your soils, I think, are older soils in geological time, and so what will tend to happen is the pH will go down. So as it goes down, then it gets more acidic. So then that's where you can start adding lime, or that's why people will add lime to their soils. So,
in other words, Eric, you're old as dirt.
So everyone, a shout out to Aaron of the Impatient Gardener, who said, Eric, you need to do a soil test. And I tried to get her on this show, but she is really busy during the week. And out of desperation for some color commentary, I invited Rick. So, and maybe there's a little too much color commentary from Rick, but there's always the edit button, you know.
That's right.
Well, I'm like, for me, this is an aha, you dummy. Why didn't you do this years ago? It's kind of like where you discover a new tool that everyone else has known about for 30 years, and you're like, oh, this makes the job so much easier. It's kind of like when I discovered the vacuum, the robot vacuum, the Roomba, which I will, shameless Amazon plug, I will link to in the show notes here. Amazon links do help us pay the bills here, so if you want to shop using our Amazon links, that's really great. But the soil test, I'm like, I've known about these for years. It's as simple as putting dirt in a bag. The hardest part is shipping it, but the post office is right down the road, you know, and then they email it back, and it's $15 a sample. So to me, it was worth $45 to get better sugar snap peas, because I've just noticed all my plants are like, they're just kind of, And it's reminded me that I just need to, I basically was like, oh, well, we'll have to be no-till. We don't have disturbed soil. And I'm like, okay, I do need to add some stuff to the soil. Scott, I was going to add, my neighbor has a big yard. He doesn't fertilize very much, but he has, he chops up the grass cuttings. He has a vacuum behind his mower. And then he chops up all the fall leaves and gets chopped up. And he makes a giant pile. And the bottom of that pile is this beautiful black compost, and I was thinking of adding that to my garden beds. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think that would be totally fine, because it's probably, because if it's got the grass and the leaves in there, it's probably a fairly good, fairly well balanced compost that's coming out of there, right?
Yes,
it could. Yeah, it's hard to say, like, it's probably going to add more of the phosphorus. It'll probably add some of the potassium too. But you know, you can get to some, if you add too much, you can get to some excessive levels, but
right.
You know, actually one thing that wasn't on here that I was surprised at was organic matter, because usually that's on soil tests.
Yes.
But then they also have the cation exchange capacity.
I saw that.
Yeah. And when it's, and they even have it in their listing as to kind of what normal values are. And so when it's yours are showing like, I think it was, let's see here, 18, 14, 16, and 12. So when they're in those ranges, that they're probably, they're, you've probably got a good supply of organic matter in the soil already. So, you know, probably you, like if you got the compost, you could put some of it on, but you don't necessarily need too much of it. I think more if you just, the potassium seems to be the big one to add that. And you'll probably get the most value for your money by just adding some potassium to the beds according to what they're,
oh, great.
You can do that. They have the calculations there. So
I was freaking out. I was looking at how to reduce phosphorus in your vegetable garden, and doing a legume cover crop was suggested. And I'm thinking, oh, I have to order clover, 2 pounds of clover seed. And it's just great to hear you, Scott, the expert, for free, by the way. Hey, Scott, want to be on the podcast?
So, you know? So with that phosphorus, yeah, you don't necessarily have to worry about lowering. It's just that you don't have to worry about adding phosphorus. And and you'll just keep using it over the years, and at some point it'll start going down. But you know, if you add too much compost, you'll probably start adding too much phosphorus again. So,
all right. Yeah. So going forward, I want to use if I'm going to use a multi-purpose fertilizer, I want the middle number to be zero if I'm shopping for a fertilizer.
Yeah, you don't need that. Yeah, you can have it low or at zero. You don't necessarily need that one. So your main one would be that the third number, the potassium, and then, you know, with the nitrogen, that's where it's a little tricky. Like maybe you, if you can find a nitrogen source that you can just add in season.
Yes.
Might, you know, kind of, as they said there too, if you start seeing them getting a little yellow or not looking as well, then you can try to add the nitrogen then, but you can definitely add the potassium before you plant and kind of mix it in, and then it's already there. So,
and again, if you're looking at a bag of fertilizer, it's NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium is K. So you want to look, I'm going to go look at that third number and pay particular attention to that. And then I want the P, the middle number, to be low or a zero. So that's great. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on and calm my mind about this. I wasn't really flipped out, but it was on the front of my mind about how do I fix my problem here.
Yeah, soil tests are something that take a while to get to try to figure them all out. And I mean, I see them very frequently in my job, so I'm used to them. I'll just we'll just finish off what the rest of the numbers on here. So that buffered pH is the only reason you'd use that is if you were adding lime, but you don't need to add lime. And the base saturation they have down there, it's a method that it was an idea that was put out at one point that you could have there was a perfect ratio for potassium, magnesium, and calcium, but it's taken on a life of its own. There's some people totally believe in it, and some people like myself see that it doesn't really work out in field trials. So I don't follow it, but if you kind of notice, they have the potassium is, they're saying it's low in the percentage, but it's also low in the total amount. So, you know, they, whether you're looking at the ratio or the total amount, it depends on how you're looking at it as to how you want to affect things. But in the end, you still have to have the total amount there. You have to bring that potassium up so that the plants have enough to go on. So,
right, because right now our base saturation for potassium is 1%, and the suggested is 2% to 7%. So, I got some work to do there.
No, but the thing is too, you could probably add the amount of potassium and bring it up to an optimum, but that percentage might still be low.
All right,
but it's not necessarily going to hurt you at that point. So it's. In my opinion, it's better to follow the total amount and not the base saturation, because they even have in their listing of, you know, when interpreting, they just say we include it because some people follow this, but they don't have any specific recommendations on it. So,
So you are a consultant for large commercial farms in Canada.
Yeah.
And do you run into the similar kind of situation with soil tests? Are they very different? Or
yeah, they can be. Yeah, they can be very. You mean in terms of what numbers are there? Or
right. Is it? I mean, I'm just kind of adventures in commercial agronomy, basically, is what I'm asking about.
Yeah, and so that's where like having a local lab is the most important thing. Like having one that's calibrated to your area, because you know each soil is different in how it, or you know how it was geologically formed, it makes mm-hmm. a difference in how you can interpret it or even extract what's in there. So. So having one that's set for your area is the best. So,
right. And my little house is in Connecticut, and I sent this to the University of Connecticut, which is probably about 100 miles away. So that was perfect.
Yeah. So that's where you go to find what your local is and go with that. And then that's where, yeah, in terms of interpreting it, like, you know, that one of the best things you can do with any type of soil testing is using the same lab, because then you can it's easier to compare results, because even though labs are supposed to be
calibrated,
they're supposed to be calibrated and they will be calibrated. They do usually do they'll do blind samples back and forth just to mm-hmm. test each other, but it's still nice if you use the same lab, because then it's a little easier to compare. So
yeah, the other thing that's useful about soil tests is several over the years, so that you have some idea of the trend. And the trend is actually in cases like yours, where the soil is pretty well balanced. The trend is what you want to pay attention to, so you can get ahead of things. You cannot just start dumping stuff because the magnesium is low and try to build that up in a 1 year and not overshoot the mark, and then you're way high, and then, you know, it's kind of like managing a swimming pool. If you try to, you know, shock it into submission at every time you go out there, it's going to overshoot the mark every time, and then you're chasing it constantly. So you're looking to adjust slightly over the years, unless you have a major disruption of some sort. The other thing I noticed here is that your lead is low, and that's very good.
Yeah, that doesn't explain my brain non-function.
Yeah. Well, that comes from, it'd be fun to see you do this up in Brooklyn, where you guys have had decades of lead exposure in the soil.
Oh, it's off the charts here.
Yeah, and then you had to dig out your yards and put in new fill. But it'd be interesting to see what it would be like there. And since you're just spending money, I think you ought to do it.
I actually, one of my best friends, I helped him renovate his 3-family, and he tested the soil in the backyard, and then the lead and chromium were off the charts, and he replaced the soil in the backyard because he has kids. So anyway, so I wanted to segue into the second part of the show here, and that Rick has this really neat worm composter, and I was curious, first of all, Scott, if what your thoughts are on adding worm compost to your garden soil, and what, I don't know if you can tell very much about Rick's composter, but is it a good one? Is there good products you've seen out there? Can you DIY this? What do you?
I've never quite seen I haven't seen that exact product. So basically, Rick, maybe explain how that works.
Okay. I have been doing worm composting for maybe a decade or so, maybe longer. And I have tried building my own worm composters. And the problem is you got to empty it and then separate out the worms from the compost, from the stuff that's still composting. And if you're doing trays where the worms migrate up from tray to tray and you're supposed to recycle the bottom ones, it's just time consuming. It's messy. And so you put it off. This is what they call a flow through worm bin. It's called a hungry bin. It's actually manufactured in New Zealand. And I got mine from Uncle Jim's Worms, which is, he gets me all of my worms, Uncle Jim's Worm Farm. And it's, if you imagine a funnel, it's large at the top, about maybe 2 foot square at the top with the lid, and it's 4 foot tall. It sits in this mobile rack with wheels on it. And the bottom of it, which is neat, it funnels down to this point, 1 foot square, and there are latches on the side, and this tray drops out of the bottom, and you get perfectly finished compost with no worms, because composting worms are going to be at the top of the bin, and this is the finished compost at the bottom. Drop it down, you empty the worm compost out, and you snap it back on. And then there's also a tray underneath it to catch the worm tea, the lichens that come out of the compost, which is wonderful for orchids and houseplants and stuff like that. And it's kind of pricey, but boy, is it good. And I just cleaned it out 3 or 4 days ago, and I pulled 15 gallons of worm castings and compost out of this bin. So I'm quite proud of it, and really thrilled to have it.
Yeah, in your picture you sent, which I will put on the website with this podcast, there's 3 5-gallon buckets full of worm compost, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and the important thing is, though, it's also we have a tremendous problem in this country with food waste, and most of it is commercial at the supermarket and restaurant level and whatnot. But even in households, if you grind up the leaves that you pull off your lettuce that are kind of brown and wilted, or you put remains, cuttings off the end and whatnot down the garbage disposal, you're adding to the problem just in general, because that's nitrogen and stuff that can be composted going into the system that the wastewater treatment plant's going to have to pull out anyway. And this way, our CSA has started just a few months ago. It's a community supported agriculture, CSA. And I am getting the most luscious greens and collards and Swiss chard and that kind of thing until mine grows in. And it's terrific to have that much green matter to play around with and making stews and soups and salads and whatnot. But I'm always concerned about how much waste there is. And this way, I just put it into the compost bin. Eventually, it breaks down. The worms don't actually eat the compost or the material. They actually eat the fungus and the bacteria, which is kind of a slime on stuff that when it's bad. The worms eat that. But then they make this wonderful casting. And it's just kind of I'm always intrigued with the virtuous loop of recycling things back into something we can eat. And so I take all that stuff and I put it in my garden, and now I have 15 gallons of compost and worm castings.
Sweet. Your thoughts, Scott?
Yeah, it's a really neat system, because basically, I guess what the idea of it is that the worm castings slowly fall to the bottom, right? And then that's where
correct.
You just pull them out.
Yeah, and it's compressed as it goes down because it has less bulk. And the worms, because red wriggler worms, compost worms, stay at the surface. You don't get worms down at the bottom of the compost bin. And so it's just, instead of managing multiple trays and that kind of thing, This just works out so much better. And I've built similar to this with scrapers that you rock on the bottom to scrape away the compost. And I've built them out of nesting trash cans. I've tried all kinds of things. This worked out to be about the best I've ever found.
Yeah, and so that's where with something like this, then it takes up a lot less space than all the having the different bins.
Right.
And it's a much quicker process when you have the worms working for you.
Yeah, this is the lazy man's. I am the garden fork resident lazy person, and so I'm always looking for the easy way to garden. The easy way to beekeep, the easy way to compost.
I love it. I love it. Hey, shameless plug here for Rad Power Bikes. I own a Rad Power e-bike and I love it. I just went down and checked on the bees in the community garden and I had a bunch of junk piled on the back of my bike. I have an affiliate link for them. If you're thinking about buying an e-bike, consider Rad Power Bikes. I think they are the best. If you use my affiliate link, that helps pay the bills here. So thanks for that. I'm wondering, because in Brooklyn, we actually have curbside composting, but that program might be cut. New York City, because of the pandemic, has lost a huge amount of tourist tax revenue. It really drives about a third of the city's tax revenue. And they're talking about canceling this program. But the other thing is we have raccoons and possums in the backyards here. So is a worm farm, is that like a target for raccoons, or you think that's less of a target than I'm thinking?
Oh, I think it would be. This has a lid that's fairly deep, and so it's difficult to get up underneath it and flip it open. And so I think it's fairly critter-proof. We have, you know, we live on the edge of a swamp, the Great Dismal Swamp, and we have lots of swamp rats and possums and raccoons, and I've never found anything in my worm bin. Once I did leave the lid open and came in the house to cool off or something, and I could hear the worms hollering, "Help, Rick, help, help, help." And the worm bin was open, and the birds were in there just grabbing worms left and right. And yeah, if worms had had shotguns, then the birds wouldn't mess with them. But the worms were unarmed and unprepared, and they were really taken advantage of. And the birds just dug through that compost like you wouldn't believe.
Wow, cool. Excellent.
Yeah, I think this, at least according to the picture there, I think this would work well when you do have those problems with critters, because it, you know, yeah, you can keep that lid closed, and you could probably find ways of even, I know that those critters always seem to be able to open up things, but you could probably find ways of securing them better, and then, because it would be a much more closed system.
Maybe right. Like a bungee cord, a super thick rubber bungee cord across the lid or something. If you did have a raccoon problem.
A rock. You know, a rock would work.
Yeah, a rock or yeah, something heavy over top of it.
Not a brick. You need a big rock. Yeah, something kind of heavy set it on top.
Very high tech, a rock. I'm thinking, let's get a security camera out there. That'll trigger a Raspberry Pi alarm, you know?
I tell you, I have been impressed. So many people have put in like Ring or what are some of the other brands, security cameras. And all of a sudden, they're seeing what's really going on around them and in their backyards and their front yards. They had no idea what's going on. And people walking by at 3 a.m. and they think they're suspicious or something. They just stand on the sidewalk and they're walking along. But the critter cams are just amazing. I've had a cat burglar that I didn't know for years here. It's a Siamese, and at 2 a.m. every morning it crosses in front of my Ring doorbell and alerts on it. And so there's, you know, a whole life going on around us at night, and we had no idea about it.
Yeah, while you sleep. Well, cool. Thank you, guys. This is great. Thanks for taking a minute to be on the show here. Scott and Rick and I are going to stick around for the after show. If you're interested in hearing more about my world, actually, Rick and Scott are both patrons, interestingly enough. But I post some behind-the-scenes stuff, my thoughts about the world. This morning, I just posted a really good video made by Vox, V-O-X, on YouTube about Frank Lloyd Wright and how he designed windows for sunlight. And it's just off the top of my head, a lot of stuff. It's pictures of the Labradors. It's little previews. It's my frustrations. But that, I'm asking a cup of coffee a month. You can learn more about that below to become a patron. I'll link to that. But We're going to stick around. That was kind of a jumbled promo, wasn't it? But anyway, I'm trying to wrap up the main show here is what I'm trying to do, well, everybody.
Yeah, what you were saying is that Rick and Scott actually pay to be on the radio.
You can't be a guest unless you're a patron. Anyway, we're going to stick around and talk about some more goofy Eric world. We're going to talk about I accidentally drank a caffeinated coffee today, so and I will share that.
Oh, good on you.
But anyway, thanks, everyone. If you know anything about soil tests, your experiences with soil tests, or your worm composter, I know there's some of you out there. It's radio@gardenfork.tv. radio@gardenfork.tv. All right. Thank you very much. Go out and do cool stuff. Garden Fork Radio is produced by Garden Fork Media LLC in Brooklyn, New York. Our producer is Sean O'Neill. If you need an amazing podcast producer, visit Sean's site, seaninbrooklyn.com. That's Sean, S-E-A-N, in Brooklyn.com. Our executive producer is Jimmy Goots. For more information about Jimmy and the custom hollow books he makes, visit hollowbooks.com. The music in the show is licensed from audioblocks.com and uniquetracks.com.